I want to go back and review a little bit to bring us up where we are and to summarize some of the points before we go into the area of prophecy and nations in history. We started out by looking at various misconceptions of the Christian faith. The first misconception was most people think that the Christian faith is a subjective faith. It doesn't matter what you believe as long as you believe it enough. But we saw that the Christian faith is an objective faith. It's faith in Jesus. We're not saved by faith. We're saved by grace through faith. It was what Jesus did on the cross. It's an objective faith in Jesus. It matters what you believe and the truth of it. Second, we saw that the Christian faith is not an ignorant faith. It's not a blind faith. It's an intelligent faith. Every time a person is called upon to exercise faith in the Scriptures, it is an intelligent faith. Then we saw that everyone approaches history with presuppositions. A presupposition is something you conclude before you ever begin the investigation. And the basic presuppositions of historians today is that every event has to have a natural explanation. Doesn't matter what it is, there has to be a natural explanation. Second, there is no God. How could you have a God if everything has a natural explanation? Third, there is no supernatural. Fourth, miracles are not possible. And they start to examine history. And before they even examine history, they've determined what they're going to find. And they come to something like the resurrection. It doesn't matter what the evidence shows, and it is sufficient. They say, I can't believe in it. Why? Very simple. No natural explanation. There is no God. There is no supernatural. Miracles are not possible. But they didn't find that out studying history. They thought it up philosophically. Now, I have presuppositions. Of course, they've changed after I set out to refute Christianity. But I've always asked two questions to my presuppositions. I felt as an individual, I can fool a lot of people. I can be dishonest with a lot of people. But there's one person I cannot fool, and one person I have to be honest with, and that's myself. And so in my study and research, I've always asked myself two questions in my presuppositions. One, do my presuppositions coincide with reality or what is? Second, is there sufficient evidence to support my presuppositions? And if there is not, then I must be willing to change. Then we saw the difference between scientific and legal evidence. Scientific evidence or method of determining truth is applied in a controlled situation where the event can be repeated and can be observed and empirically verified. The legal approach is based upon the sufficiency of the evidence. In other words, a verdict is reached on the basis of the evidence. Now, certain events within history and life of an individual basically has to have the legal method applied to it because you cannot repeat it. Like somebody says, can you prove to me scientifically Jesus Christ, the Son of God? No, because I cannot repeat it in a controlled environment, observation made, empirically verified. You have to apply the legal method, which is based upon oral testimony, written testimony, and exhibits. Now, using that, you can pretty well show that Jesus Christ claimed to be the Son of God and was the Son of God. But you couldn't do it scientifically. You couldn't prove scientifically that Martin Luther King was a civil rights leader. You can't repeat it in a controlled environment. Observation made, data drawn, hypothesized, empirically verified. You have to apply the legal method. Then, we saw that Christianity is not a religion, but a relationship with Jesus Christ. From there, we went in to a definition of history. How does one define history? I have asked more than 200 history majors to give me a definition of history, and I've never had more than two ever been able to give me, and both of them were students at Biola College. Over 200 history majors. In a moment I meet somebody who's a history major, I'll fire back. Give me a definition of history. You know, almost every one of them responds this way. Boy, that's a tough one. And they're a history major. I remember in a history class. In fact, it was a class where the guy sat over in the corner and snickered. Remember I shared that illustration about laughing at the New Testament being reliable and he didn't have any test to apply? The same man, after that, I said, sir, I said, what is your definition of history? He said, well, the Greeks believe. I said, not what the Greeks believe. What is your definition? He said, well, the Romans. I said, not what the Romans taught. What is your definition? He didn't have any. Well, I think a fairly adequate definition of history is a knowledge or a record of the past based upon testimony. So he said, I don't believe that. He said, well, you believe Napoleon lived? Yes. Did you see him? No. Testimony. Written testimony, oral testimony, and exhibits. Now, when you define history, a knowledge of the past based upon testimony, you have one problem with that definition. Is your testimony reliable? Now, basically, Christianity is a knowledge of the past based upon testimony. Oral testimony and written testimony. Oral testimony of the apostles and the written testimony of the scriptures. Are they reliable? Well, Monday night we looked at the written testimony. And we saw that there was as much evidence for the reliability of the New Testament as any 10 pieces of classical literature put together. We saw three tests. We looked at one in detail. The biographical test, internal evidence, and external evidence test. In chapter 4 of my first book, all three of these are documented. We looked at the manuscripts. We saw that there are over 15,000 manuscripts in the New Testament alone. And the number two book in history on manuscript authority is the Iliad with 643 manuscripts in over 15,000 of the New Testament. Then Tuesday night, we start out by looking at the oral testimony. Can we trust what the apostles and the writers in the New Testament related about Jesus Christ? Can we really trust what they said and wrote? Well, here were 12 men. 11 of the 12 died martyrs' deaths for one thing, an empty tomb, and the appearances of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, the critics would complain in two areas. One, they'd say, well, big deal, a lot of people have died for a lie. Yes, a lot of people have died for a lie, but they thought it was the truth. And we looked Tuesday night at this, and we saw that if the resurrection was a lie, there were 12 men that knew it, the apostles. And the apostles then not only died for a lie, but they knew it was a lie. And it'd be difficult to find 11 men in history that not only died for a lie, but they knew it was a lie. And a lot of people have died for a lie, but they thought it was the truth. They signed their testimony in blood. They said for 40 days they walked with Jesus. They ate with him. Then some people say, well, a lot of people have died for a great cause. Like the Buddhists in Vietnam burning themselves over the war. Yes, but the great cause of the apostles died in the cross. We saw that the Jews had the concept of Messiah, that when the Messiah would come, he would be a reigning political Messiah. He would release the Jews from Roman bondage. He would reign the world from Israel. And that's why they couldn't understand Jesus. Jesus kept saying, I came to die first. Then I'm going to come back and reign. I came to suffer for your sins. Then I'll come back and reign. And the apostles all the time, is it now, Lord, you're going to set up your kingdom? Can we reign in your right hand? They couldn't understand him because they thought he'd be a reigning political Messiah. But he went and got crucified. And they were totally discouraged because their great cause died on the cross. But something happened that turned their lives upside down, and each one went out and died a martyr's death. And the only thing that could have caused that was a resurrection. And I've concluded that I can trust the testimony of the apostles and what they have related more than almost anyone that I meet today, because they were willing and they went on and gave their lives for what they propagated. Then we went into the deity of Jesus Christ. We saw very clearly in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Jesus claimed to be God. And one area that was quite unique was the trial of Jesus. Very unusual for history of legal trials, because most people are tried for what they did. Isn't that true? But Jesus was tried for who he was. The issue in the trial of Jesus was not what he did, but who was he? Pilate said, why do you want to put him to death? And the religious leaders cried out, because he, being a man, makes himself out to be God. And the very trial of Jesus confirmed that he claimed to be God. Now, Jesus claimed to be God. There's two alternatives. It is either true or it was false. If it was false, we saw a trilemma in the sense that, one, he knew it was false. That would mean he was a liar. Second, he didn't know it was false. That means he was self-deceived. That'd make him a lunatic. Like someone today believing himself to be Napoleon. He was either a liar or a lunatic, or the only other alternative is that it was true and he was Lord and God. He was either a liar, a lunatic, or Lord and God. We saw that we cannot come to the nonsense conclusion that Jesus Christ is a great moral teacher or a good man. You can't say that. Because to say what Jesus said and claimed what Jesus claimed, you can't call him a good man. How could he be a good man and mislead people at the most important point of his teaching, his own identity? I mean, for a man to say that your relationship with God depends on how you're related to me, and if that's not true, how can you call him a good man? And yet, if you go out in the street, every one of you here in between now and Christmas, say, who do you think Jesus was? Almost every person say, well, he's a good man, a good prophet, a great religious person. Think he was more than that? No. And that'll show you the ignorance of people about Jesus today. Then Wednesday, we looked at the resurrection. We saw the various evidence, historical evidence for it. 100-some-pound encasement around the body in a tomb 4.5 to 5 feet tall. A 1.5 to 2-ton stone rolled against the entrance. A Roman guard unit of 4 to 16 men placed at the tomb, and a Roman seal put on it. And we saw that something happened. The seal was broken. When that seal was broken, the FBI, CIA, and everything else, the Roman Empire, was thrown into finding that people. And when they were found, it was automatic crucifixion upside down. The 1.5 to 2-ton stone was rolled up a slope away from not just the entrance, but the entire sepulcher, looking like it had been picked up and carried away. And the tomb was empty. Then last night, we looked at messianic prophecy of the first coming of Jesus Christ. The Old Testament, written over a period of 1,000 years, contains almost 330-some prophecies, all fulfilled in one person, Jesus Christ. And we saw some of those prophecies last night. The rest are documented in chapter 9 of the first book. And then we saw the mathematical probability of just 8 of those prophecies being fulfilled in any one individual would be 1 in every 1 times 10 to the 17th power. That's 17 zeros. For 48, it's 150 zeros probability. Then we saw the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. He was one of the greatest antagonists of the Christian faith. He became one of the greatest protagonists, a murderer that became a missionary, because in his own words, the resurrected Christ appeared to him. And one thing we know of history, he changed from Saul of Tarsus to the Apostle Paul and became one of the greatest propagators of the Christian faith. And about the only logical historical explanation for it is that Jesus Christ appeared to him. Now tonight, I'd like to go into prophecy fulfilled in nations, predicted in the Scriptures. When the Bible was written, more than 25% of it was prophetic when it was written. See, Deuteronomy points out that the Jewish prophets had various tests. And when they would meet a heathen prophet, they would usually challenge them to predict the future, because the Jewish prophet had to be able to predict it with 100% accuracy. If they were inaccurate, they were stoned to death if they prophesied in the name of the Lord. Prophecy was given to confirm the Scriptures as God's revelation to man and woman. And if you have any doubt about the existence of God and His control in history, then I will challenge you to take my first book and refute chapter 11 on prophecy and some of the things that I'm going to be sharing tonight. I told my wife when I worked in this section that my spinal cord would just vibrate. I don't know how anyone can read the prophecy, study the datings and the manuscripts and the fulfillment in detail hundreds of years later and not come to the conclusion that God, Yahweh, exists. And I'll challenge you to refute chapter 11. Let me show you what I mean. Now, I won't be able to give a lot of the little nitty-gritty details. We'd be here all night with that. In chapter 11, it's completely documented, the dating and everything, and all the details of these prophecies. First one I want to look at is in Ezekiel 26. Ezekiel 26. Let me get a pen here. Ezekiel 26, 592 B.C. There was a prophecy about the city of Tyre, which right now is in the southern part of Lebanon. It was the last city you read in the newspapers. Well, it actually wasn't this city. That city is 40 miles away. But to mention the name Tyre, where the Syrian troops moved into it. But it's not this city. And you'll see why in the next few minutes. There was a prophecy about the original city of Tyre. 592 B.C. First of all, Nebuchadnezzar will destroy the mainland city of Tyre. Second, many nations will come up against Tyre. Third, will make her a bare rock. Fourth, fishermen will spread nets over the site. Fifth, they will throw, or the debris will be scraped into the water. The debris from the city that is destroyed will be scraped into the water, the Mediterranean. Sixth, never to be rebuilt. And seventh, never to be founded again. Or, which these actually go right together, it's just a repetition. Be founded or gain its power. Now, what happened in history? Now, this is pretty minute detail of a prophecy. You know, I used to wonder, why did the Jews reverence the scriptures? You know why I used to wonder that? There's probably no people that are prouder, and no people that have a basis to be prouder, than the Jews. And yet, here is a book, the Old Testament, that literally criticizes the Jews, constantly putting the Jews down, correcting them, showing all their mistakes, their lack of faith, their departing from God, all the way through. And yet the Jews just adamantly adhere to the Old Testament. Now, you try to write a book today, it'd be a bestseller in Israel, and criticize Israel. You'd never make it. And yet the Old Testament is a bestseller. And yet it criticizes Israel. Now why? Prophecy. Prophecy confirmed to the Jews that it was the very word of God to them. And that's why they reverenced it. Even though it criticized them. And a lot of it's right because of prophecy. Now let's see what happened. In 592... Now, it wasn't a tremendous prophecy at the moment to predict that Nebuchadnezzar would come and destroy the mainland city of Tyre. Nebuchadnezzar was the power of Babylon. However, in history, you saw very little fighting between Nebuchadnezzar and Tyre because of the people in Tyre were the naval power. And the people from Babylonia were the military power, and they very seldom interfered with each other. And yet in 583, Nebuchadnezzar came and laid siege to the city of Tyre, and laid siege for 13 years. Can you imagine that? Laying siege to a city for 13 years. Finally, after 13 years, they broke the walls down. And they got into the city. And there wasn't anyone there. 13 years they laid siege and there wasn't anyone there! Boy, was he ticked off! You know what happened? Here was the coast. Off the coast there was an island about a half mile out. And the Phoenicians, with their ships, had been moving supplies and materials out to the island, and they built the city out there. And so Nebuchadnezzar leveled the city. And for over 200 years, the city was leveled. Then, Alexander the Great, several hundred years later, set out to conquer the known world. He had a problem. He feared the people of Tyre because of their naval might on the island. And he was afraid that while he was out with his armies, the Phoenicians would attack Greece from the water with their naval force, and conquer his own country. So he knew he had to destroy Tyre. Now, the prophecy several hundred years before said many nations would come up against Tyre. Well, Alexander the Great went and conquered the other nations around Tyre. And then he combined all of their naval forces. And he attacked the city of Tyre on the island. Now, Alexander the Great, who is one of my heroes of history, one because he's mentioned in the scripture so much, but he was a brilliant man. He's one of the men that created Koine Greek verb system. His counselor was Aristotle. Now, the people living in Tyre weren't dumb, even though they didn't have Plato as their counselor. So what the people in Tyre did, here they had the island, and underneath the water, they placed these huge pillars pointing out from the island. And as Alexander the Great approached with his ship, they were punctured and they sunk. And that got him out of fellowship. And so he just about lost his entire naval fleet. And so he got his troops back on the land. And he reorganized his army. Now, it says it'd be a bare rock and the debris would be scraped into the water. Alexander the Great took the debris from the city that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed and scraped it into the Mediterranean. And he built a causeway out to the island, a road. And then he marched his troops out there, and after a seven-month battle, he destroyed the city of Tyre. Now, down through the ages, they tried to rebuild it, and it was destroyed, and then rebuilt, and then destroyed. And now it's never been rebuilt again. This was first brought to my attention by the National Geographic magazine, when it went through the details of the prophecy and then showed pictures of Tyre. And there were the spreading of fishing nets. And it's never been rebuilt to this day. And yet, one of the biggest problems in that area for cities is fresh water. And at the site of Tyre, there's wells, natural wells, that produce 18 million gallons of fresh water a day. And it's never been rebuilt. Now, the city that's called Tyre now is not on the site of the original city. It's away from there, about 40 miles. In detail, fulfilled. And this is what caused the Jews to constantly look back to the scriptures. Now, let's look at another prophecy. Babylon. In Isaiah 11, Isaiah 11, Isaiah 14, Jeremiah 51, and Daniel, the book of Daniel, the first seven chapters, basically. Isaiah 11, 14, which has the detail of the prophecies, is written right around 750 B.C. 750 B.C. Now, these are the minute predictions of Babylon, written hundreds of years before their fulfillment. One, Babylon was to be like Sodom and Gomorrah, destroyed. Second, never inhabited again. Third, tents not placed there by the Arabs. Fourth, sheepfolds will not be there. Fifth, desert creatures will infest the ruins. Sixth, stones not removed for other construction projects. Seventh, the ancient city will not be frequently visited. The ruins will be very seldom visited. Eighth, it will be covered by swamps of water after it's destroyed. Now what happened? The Babylon Empire and the city of Babylon was founded actually by Hammurabi. And then Nabopolassar, who was the son of Nebuchadnezzar, mentioned in Daniel, really made the city of Babylon great by the time Nebuchadnezzar came along, around 600 B.C., 150 years after the prophecies. In Daniel, the king Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And in the dream, he saw this huge image. And he couldn't find anyone to interpret it for him. None of the wise men. So he's going to have all the wise men put to death. And Daniel said, I can interpret the dream. And it was so neat when Daniel said, there is a God in heaven. He never missed an opportunity to witness. He said, there is a God in heaven that can give the answer. And what it was a description of four empires. And he said, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold on this image. And the Medes and the Persians are going to destroy you. And then after the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks will come along. And then after the Greeks, the Empire of Iron or Rome. Now when Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar that the Medes and the Persians would destroy him, he must have laughed. As records show that they laughed at these prophecies for a while. Let me tell you why they probably laughed. The city of Babylon, I think I could say, was probably the most fortified city that ever has existed for the military know-how of its day. There is no comparison in ancient history to the city of Babylon. Now try to imagine this in your mind. You won't be able to. It is so gigantic and powerful. Now try to imagine it all. Here was a city, and this was 2,600 years ago. A city that was 196 square miles. It was on each side 14 miles, 56 square miles in circumference. The city had two walls around it. Now the outer wall was 311 feet high. Now, men and women, that's equivalent of a 30-story building. How high is this right here? How much? 28 feet. Can you imagine 10, 12, almost 13 times higher than this? A 30-story building. Now, the wall was 86 feet thick. 11 cars could drive across it abreast. And can you imagine that? 30 stories high. Now the average width of a wall at that time was 9 to 18 feet. But Babylon, 87 feet wide. It had 100 gates of solid brass. It had 250 watchtowers. 100 feet, each one of them higher than the wall. That means 40 stories high. 250 of the towers. See, I told you it'd be a little hard to imagine. About the size of Escondido. The inner wall was 75 feet high and 32 feet wide, which is even larger than the average wall at that time of your fortified cities. So it had a double wall. Outside of the wall, there was a 30-foot wide moat of water all the way around the outside of the city. The city had enough supplies for 17 years within the wall for a siege. Had all the fresh water it needed for ages because the Euphrates River ran right through the center of it. Powerful of the people. Well, what happened? The Persians came and they laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. I mean, to the city of Babylon. For 3 years. And the Babylonians just laughed at them and mocked them from the walls. They couldn't do a thing for 3 years. At that time, there were two deserters from Babylon. One by the name of Gobryas and the other Gadatas. They had their ears cut off. They'd actually been thrown out of the city. And having ears cut off was a way of disgracing. They went to the Persians. And at the time they went to the Persians, Chrysantas, who was a counselor to Cyrus, pointed out that the Euphrates River that went underneath the walls, it was deep enough to march an army under. So they laid plans to attack the city of Babylon from within, not from without. And they started to dig canals. And they built a dam and changed the course of the Euphrates River. And the night they did it, the Babylonians were all drunk. They were celebrating an annual feast, which is talked about in Daniel 8. And they were celebrating this feast and mocking and laughing at their enemies. While that was happening, they changed the course of the river, and as history has confirmed, they marched underneath the walls and took the city without a battle. Often reminds you of what is happening right now in the United States. We're falling from within, not from without. We have some of the greatest defenses in the world, and yet we're starting to crumble from within society. Now in Babylon, it was literally destroyed like Sodom and Gomorrah. It has never been inhabited again. In fact, it was totally lost in history until 1900 A.D., I think it was 1820, an Englishman by the name of Rich, a Mr. Rich, lived in Baghdad. He went up to this part and started to dig around and started to discover the ruins of Babylon. For almost 3,000 years, it was lost in history. No trace of it whatsoever. In fact, for a while, they called it a myth, because most of the references were in the scriptures. You will not find the sheepfolds there or the Arabs, because there's some tradition that's developed up that it's spooked. And they're scared of it, of the evil spirits. One account that I read, a secular account from Egypt, describes the desert creatures that have totally invaded the area. An interesting account that I read is that its stones have not been removed, even though they're huge ones that were brought there for building. And the other cities have been discovered around it. The stones have been taken for building new things, but the stones of Babylon have not been used. And very few tours go to Babylon. It's hardly ever frequented. And now a swamp has developed almost over the entire area. Men and women predicted hundreds and hundreds of years before in minute detail. Now, there was a sister city to Babylon, the city of Nineveh. Now, Nineveh, you can find some of the prophecies here in Nahum, written 661 B.C., before Christ. Now, the prophecies about Nineveh is, one, it would be destroyed in a state of drunkenness. Second, would be destroyed in an overflowing flood. Third, would be burned. Now, you almost have a contradiction here. It's pretty hard to have fire when you have a flood, especially in those days. And then fourth, it'd be totally destroyed and never rebuilt. Now, what has happened in history? You know, it's so funny. When I did research on this, reading secular accounts that were aware of biblical prophecy, and so many of them became very sober. And it really caused them, and you can see it in their writings, change their attitude towards the scriptures. As they saw the literal fulfillments, and they could check out the datings in the manuscripts. Now, the city of Tyre was developed by the Assyrians. The Tigris River ran just to the west of it. The walls of this city was 100 feet tall, 10-story building, 50 feet thick. This, we'd almost have to say, was the number two fortified city in history. 50 feet thick, had towers that were 200 plus feet tall, each one of them around the city, had 15 gates of solid brass, but this city had a 150-foot moat around the city, 150 feet wide, half a football field, isn't it? Yeah. Now, wait a minute. Right. I'm getting changed over to the metric system and still having trouble with feet. Half a football field wide moat, and it was 7 miles in circumference, a lot smaller than Babylon. Actually, Nabopolassar, who fortified Babylon in 625 B.C., broke away from Nineveh and the Assyrians rebelled and went to Babylon. Then actually Babylon came back to destroy Nineveh. The king of Assyria had camped outside the walls. Their enemy, led by a man from Egypt. Real long name, hard to remember. But this man had laid siege to another city of... Oh. I'm sorry, my mind went blank. But he laid siege to it for 29 years before he conquered it. Can you imagine keeping your troops outside of a city for 29 years, waiting for him to starve to death? They were on a diet. But they came here. And the Assyrians were so assured of victory that the king went out and started to meet with the troops. And they had a big feast of wine and alcohol. As historical accounts say, the majority of the troops were drunk. One man deserted and went to the camp of the enemy and told the enemy general, his name was Arbus, and told him the situation. They checked it out. That night they got the troops together and attacked the Assyrians outside the city when they were drunk. And he just almost destroyed them, and they fled into the city. And they secured the city. And they also started to mock their enemies outside the wall. The Assyrian leader was a man of the name of Sardanapalus. And he started to celebrate the victory over their enemies. But he had remembered a prophecy. Now, it was a secular prophecy, but was taken from the scriptures. Motivated. And this is what the prophecy read. No enemy will ever take Nineveh. In the prophecy it says Nimus, which was Nineveh. No enemy will ever take Nineveh by storm unless the river shall first become the city's enemy. Now remember the prophecy. First of all, in a state of drunkenness, which was outside the wall. Second, would be destroyed in an overflowing flood. After a long siege, it's actually 3 years, the Tigris River almost immediately rose to flood stage. And it flooded over. And it wiped out a part of the wall that crumbled. And so the enemies are outside here for 3 years, got ready to attack. With the Assyrian king, saw what had happened. And because of the prophecy, he panicked. And he got all of his provisions into the temple area, the heathen temple area. Got all of his concubines, all of his slaves, everyone. And it was actually the palace, not the temple. Got him into the palace, sealed it, and then burned it to the ground. Because of the prophecy. Nineveh was totally lost in history until the 19th century A.D. Absolutely no record of it until they discovered the ruins. It was an absolute fulfillment of prophecy. Now, Jesus gave a prophecy in Matthew 11 about four cities, and I just visited one of them several weeks ago. Four cities in Matthew 11, 20 to 24. Whoops. Matthew 11. Verse 20 starting. Then he began to reproach the cities in which most of his miracles were done because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the miracles had occurred in Tyre and Sidon, which occurred in you, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. Nevertheless, I say to you, it should be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? You shall descend to Hades, for if the miracles had occurred in Sodom, which occurred in you, it would have remained to this day. Nevertheless, I say to you that it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. Now, there was a quadrangle of four cities. Chorazin, Bethsaida, Capernaum, and Tiberias. They were all located on or near the coast of the Lake Sea of Galilee, one of the most beautiful areas of Israel. One of the few beautiful areas of Israel. Let's look at what happened in history. Now, Jesus gave this prophecy when he lived 2,000 years ago. 400 years later, a severe earthquake hit, destroyed Bethsaida, Chorazin, and Capernaum. Chorazin was totally lost. In fact, the only reference in history was in the 4th century, Eusebius, the historian, said that Chorazin had existed 4 Roman miles from Capernaum. And now there's no trace of it left. They can't find it anywhere. In Bethsaida and Capernaum, they tried to rebuild. But every time the king or someone else tried to rebuild, they died. The person in charge. And to this day, Capernaum and Bethsaida are ruins. And yet the fourth city of the quadrangle, the fourth city, which was not prophesied against, remains a flourishing city today. Four cities, 3 of them Jesus prophesied against, and all 3 have gone into ruins, and only one remains, Capernaum, that was not prophesied against. Men and women, God has confirmed his scriptures as the very revealed word of God. And I believe any person that takes time to examine the prophecies will come to the conclusion that God had to reveal the scriptures.